The Carter and the Panama Canal Treaty.
Carter expended a large proportion of his foreign policy chips to get that through and barely managed to do it and shot a lot. It was a big decision on his part. It's hard for an administration at any time. It's harder still for an administration that's getting ready to face a re-election campaign or for an administration that's becoming a lame duck administration when it's no longer likely to face to submit itself to re-election. So the first point I want to make is that it's got to be a high priority. And for various reasons, a number of these particular treaties that we've been talking about just haven't made it onto high enough priority on the agenda or on the sort of scale of concerns of the administrations that have been dealing with them. The second point I wanted to make is that one of the big problems, I think, from the point of view of ratifying these treaties is not so much a kind of parochialism, as Doug suggested, but the Americans in the post-war period have always thought of the American empire as a liberal empire and a cosmopolitan empire. This, of course, may seem different looked at from non-American vantage points, I admit, but the Americans have always sort of portrayed themselves as broad-minded and a different kind of an empire, a liberal empire, an empire beyond reproach with respect to sensitivity and concern for all of these sorts of rights questions. After all, look at the 200-year glorious history and our sacred documents and so on. And therefore, the fact that people push these issues is somehow or other perceived within this sort of worldview as a kind of a criticism. Something that's sort of, you know, why do you need to raise these kinds of problems? Of course, it goes without saying that Pax Americana is sensitive to these kinds of things. It doesn't need to be enshrined in these documents, and the move to do so is niggling criticism that shouldn't really be made. And the third point that I wanted to raise is that as we go on now into the 80s and further into the Reagan era, awful as that may be from a lot of points of view, we are, as you all know, moving into an era in which the senior officials of the American federal government are now more and more taking a kind of a knee-jerk negative attitude toward almost anything associated with the United Nations and the specialized agencies of it. Now, it's a long story and a sad story as to why this is the case, but increasingly politically in this country, anything that can be associated with the United Nations and its connected organizations will almost automatically be regarded in a rather skeptical light at best, and more likely a negative light. And that's a very unhappy development. It's a very unfortunate thing, but it's a political reality in this country that can't be denied.
David, did you have? Look, it's past 4:30, and I think we have to adjourn. But David and I and Rosita had to go to see the eye doctor this afternoon, but she'll be back tomorrow. We'll carry on tomorrow morning with this discussion with Sandy and Henry, and then perhaps move on to other matters. I think everyone's eager to continue the discussion tomorrow. And so I suggest that we start at our usual time, 9 a.m. precisely.
What about Washington?
Since you asked, I just happen to be carrying this around. I don't know. I can go ahead.
That was a very good explanation that you just gave. It was real helpful.
Thank you. Well, it's nice. I wish it were more optimistic. At least it explains some of the...
Yeah, it really helped me. It made it clear and it'll enable me to
explain. You're welcome. 212, I think. Federally recognized. Some are, 78 are IRA. See, a lot of it, I think, right.
Well, I'm sure Dr. Kane not only just found more things, but represents he wanted this. And I don't think I can find all that in one shot. I think you know, I think these ways to
take greater advantage of your health.
Well, let's take our seats. Well, this is the last day of our round table, and I bellow like this early in the morning just to see if I can't get everybody's attention, and so let me welcome you all back to the last day of our last roundtable and the last public session of the Alaska Native Review Commission. This may turn out to be an historic day, so you all should feel that it may well be a day to be remembered. So let me suggest what our course of action ought to be today. Some of our participants have had to leave. I've taken the liberty of asking Mary Miller, who's seated next to Rosita Worrell, to sit in this morning. Mary Miller is from Nome, and she is with Kowarik, the nonprofit regional association in Bering Straits. And she was a participant in our December roundtable and prepared a paper for that roundtable. It constituted the work she had done for her master's thesis in public policy in Oregon. Steve Cackwee arrived yesterday, and he is seated next to Henry Hsu. Steve is from Yellowknife. He is the president of the Dene Nation. And he was here for the March Roundtable in 1984, and it is, I think, fortunate that he is here now to make the circle complete in a way. And later on this morning, after we've completed our discussion of international developments, I'll take the liberty of asking Steve to bring us up to date on what has been happening in the Canadian Arctic and subarctic. What I thought we would do this morning was to ask Sandy Davis and Henry Hsu to carry on with the discussion that Bernie Nietschmann and Doug Sanders began yesterday, and to which Clem Chartier and Professor Hanke contributed. And then I thought we had asked Steve to follow on, Steve Cacfui, and then I thought we would see if the educators present wish to address the question that was raised yesterday by Robert Goldwyn. Are there certain criteria for self-determination in education that it might be appropriate to discuss? Because, of course, the place of native people in the Western world is defined not only by law and constitutional arrangements, but by what goes on in people's heads, in native heads and in non-native heads. And a good deal of what goes on in people's heads is what's placed in those heads when they are in school. So it seems to me it is entirely appropriate, if you wish, to follow on after we've heard from Steve Cacfui, with some observations from Oscar Coagley and Verna Kirkness and Gard Kiloha and Raina Green and others, of course. I mention them because they contributed so importantly to the discussion that began yesterday. And, of course, Robert Goldwyn, who participated also in that. So, having said that, perhaps we could begin, and I will ask Sandy. I think it might be right to proceed with you next.
Well, I'm going to talk about one institution that has been involved in the international arena in terms of trying to support certain standards of human rights, especially in relation to indigenous people. I've been, since September, working at the Organization of American States in Washington with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which on the level of the Western Hemisphere of the Americas is the intergovernmental regional agency, which is equivalent to the United Nations and equivalent in some sense to the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations, although the Inter-American Commission is structured somewhat differently. I think to point out, it's kind of interesting that the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man, which was instituted in March 1948, at the 8th Inter-American Conference in Bogota in Colombia, actually predates the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by about 6 months or 8 months. The drafting of the American Declaration is really the, in some sense, the model for the UN Declaration, as well as discussions that took place in the 1930s and then in 1945 by the Inter-American Commission of Jurists, perhaps in some sense did serve as the model for the UN Declaration. This may have, for anyone who's interested in the history, may have some implications for what Professor Hanke was saying yesterday about the Spanish origins of some of these rights. That's not to say, though, that the American Declaration of Human Rights doesn't have the same contradictions and problems, at least from the point of view of indigenous peoples, that the UN Declaration of Human Rights, i.e., it looks at individual rights rather than group rights. The same rights are listed in the American Declaration: the right to life, the right to due process, the right to equality before the law, the right to property, etc. The right to assembly and association, but those rights are always expressed as being possessed by the individual or the person rather than the group. The other aspect of the American Declaration of Human Rights, which makes it somewhat different than the evolution in the UN Declaration and UN Human Rights Covenants, is in 1948, the American Commission of Jurists, which designed the first draft and the second draft of the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man, included a whole section on social, economic, and cultural rights, as well as political and civil rights. The United States strongly reacted and lobbied against that, the inclusion of economic, social, and cultural rights. They successfully lobbied against it, such that there isn't, as part of the American Declaration, there's only one article that has to do with directly with social and cultural rights. And they included an appendix, again under U.S. pressure, that had to do with the duties of the individual vis-a-vis society and the obligations of the individual, as well as the rights of the individual. I think that makes it a little bit different than the UN, some of the evolution in the UN, and also expresses the role of the United States in the OAS, which has been a very dominant role in the OAS. Although, as I'll point out a little bit later, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has had a history which most people recognize is a very independent history from the U.S. role in the larger organization. Well, with that said, the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man is the real basis of the whole structure of human rights discussion in the Inter-American system, although there's a convention that was passed, drafted in 1969, an American Convention on Human Rights, and which actually, after I believe they had to have 12 or 15 or 17 signers of it, by 1979 went into effect. So currently, there are several nations in the Americas. The U.S. has not signed the American Convention on Human Rights, the first article of which has to do with the right to life, and the first an item within the first article has to do with capital punishment, which, according to the signers, is a violation of the right to life, and therefore has not been signed by, in fact, the whole history of U.S. some U.S. law in the last decade or two is against that. But that doesn't mean that the United States isn't part of the American Declaration of Human Rights of 1948, although not the 1969 convention. For the first decade after the American Declaration was signed, there was no implementing institution to monitor whether state parties to the American Declaration were actually fulfilling the standards set in that document. I believe the UN Commission on Human Rights was established soon after the Declaration, and Eleanor Roosevelt was the first head of it. Is that right?
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. The OAS was more involved in things like what to do about the intervention in Guatemala in 1954. There was not a commission on human rights until 1959. In 1959, the Inter-American Commission was established to ensure that the principles in the American Declaration and the standards set there were actually being promoted by and followed by the various states in the Western Hemisphere. And this year, actually 1984, was the 25th anniversary of the establishment of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the 25th anniversary of the establishment of the American Commission. 1973 was the 25th anniversary of the American Declaration, 1973. When they established the Commission on Human Rights, the Inter-American Commission, they did something very interesting. It was designed, the commission as well as the declaration, were designed by jurists rather than diplomats. Although some jurists and lawyers are diplomats, many of them, I don't even know if it's the majority of them, the people who actually designed the American Declaration and the regulations for the Inter-American Commission were all practicing jurists, many of whom were connected with the association, the Inter-American Association of Jurists. And they designed the Inter-American Commission to ensure that the seven members of the Inter-American Commission would be nominated by the various states that form part of the OAS, the Organization of American States, but would not be representatives of those states. Each state, when there would be an opening on the commission, would submit the names of different peoples, and then all of the states in the General Assembly in secret ballot would take the full list of names and decide who would be the fill the vacancy on the commission. And since the beginning of the commission, every member of the commission has been a jurist or a lawyer. They never had an Eleanor Roosevelt to found the commission or anything like that. There has never been anyone on the commission, except presently the American is a journalist, actually, who is the present American member of the commission, who works for Freedom House in New York and was recently. There's always been, of the seven members, a North American, a U.S. member of the commission. There's always been a U.S. member of the commission, and until recently. One thing that making jurists who aren't representative of the states is it means that the politics are involved in what the Inter-American Commission does. There's no doubt that politics are involved, but there's some degree of freedom for the Inter-American Commission that it has from the general policy of the OAS. In a moment, I'll show what the importance of that's been. I believe the Human Rights Commission are made up of representatives nominated by the states themselves, and they represent their governments on the commission. Is that right? I'm not sure of that.
I guess that's true, yeah. I forget the level at which they've become supposedly neutral experts.
In the Inter-American Commission, they take that very seriously, you know, that they're not representing their government in designing that. The other thing, in 1959, when they set down the regulations for the commission, and these are in much greater detail in the 1969 American Convention, they really outlined in very specific regulations and articles of the regulations what the functions of the commission would be. The commission does what Doug outlined yesterday. It's not an adjudicating body. It has no policing power. It can't send a task force around the world to ensure that their decisions are actually carried out by states. But what it can do is receive complaints. The most fundamental thing that was set up was in order to promote the standards set out in the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man. It was set up as a monitoring institution to ensure that states were actually conducting themselves in such a way to not to violate those rights. So it was set up as a watchdog for states. And in order to carry out its functions, it was given the right itself to accept complaints from both individuals and from non-governmental organizations. So it could receive complaints from individuals about violations of the various articles or from non-governmental organizations. It can also, its function is to take those complaints and then to assess whether those complaints are actually true or not. It has the right to petition information from the member governments of the OAS about whether what their response to those complaints about governmental behavior are. It also has the right, which is extremely important, to do on-site visits. And of all the human rights agencies, the UN Human Rights Agency and the European Commission on Human Rights, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, from the various on-site visits that it's done, has a reputation of being very, very excellent in its way of conducting on-site investigations. It will often go, all seven members of the commission or special commissions of three members will go to countries like Chile after the coup or to El Salvador or to Argentina. It will go into the prisons and interview people. It will interview the members of the judiciary. It will interview labor unions. It will interview church people, et cetera. As we'll see, it will interview sometimes indigenous leaders, too. So this on-site investigation is very important in the Inter-American Commission, but it has to be invited by the government to actually go and do an on-site visit. All during the 1960s, it tried to be invited by Cuba and was never invited. Cuba never answered the letters of the commission and argued that the commission was an arm of the, really, the U.S. government. Cuba still has a position in the OAS, but, and at times there's been some quiet diplomacy about getting Cuba back into the OAS. It still has a chair there, but it hasn't had a candidate. Isn't a member of the OAS, I believe. I don't know what the history of that is, but Paraguay has never let the Inter-American Commission do an on-site visit, although for the last 10 years it's been trying to get into Paraguay. Brazil in 1973 refused to let the Inter-American Commission come in for an on-site visit. On the other hand, the Inter-American Commission has been to Haiti, it's been to El Salvador, it's been to Guatemala, it's been to Nicaragua, both before and after the Nicaraguan Revolution. It's been to Panama, Bolivia, Colombia. So it has made some very important on-site visits. And finally, it could take complaints, it could question governments, it can make on-site visits, it could call people before it, individuals or non-governmental organizations who make complaints to provide evidence and oral testimony. And finally, after assessing all this bundle of evidence, it comes out with either reports or resolutions. That's all it could really do. It comes out with a, I have one of the reports with me on the mosquito, and I'll talk a little. That's all it could do is come out with reports and resolutions. The resolutions are read on the floor of the General Assembly of the Order of American States, and then published in the annual report of the OAS. The reports on specific countries usually are printed and are part of the public domain. Now, one could say that's not very powerful. But what actually has turned out is that the OAS, the Inter-American Commission reports, have proved to be significant documents in influencing public opinion, and by influencing public opinion, having effect on the behavior of states in relation to what they do in terms of human rights violations. There is very little doubt that OAS on-site visit to Argentina in the late 1970s had an enormous impact on the overthrow of the military government and the transition to civilian rule. That and an incident called the Malvinas Falklands, a political thing, the Malvinas, the Falklands, and on the other hand, especially the investigation of disappearances. It was the longest on-site investigation they ever did. It was 15 days, which is relatively long. Most on-site visits are 3 or 4 days by international human rights bodies. And they did 15 days in Argentina, and they interviewed thousands of people, really with their staff and with their with the 7 members of the commission there. And their report on Argentina brought enormous public opinion. In Somoza's period, their report on this, especially in 1977 or 78, when Somoza was bombing his own civilian populations, the Inter-American Commission came out with a report which led to the Political Consultative Committee of the OAS passing a resolution. Usually in their report, they make recommendations of what the government could do. In the report on Nicaragua, they made absolutely no recommendations because they would assume that it shouldn't be a legitimate government anymore. And that led, was a very important aspect of the overthrow and the lack of legitimacy. In Guatemala, they brought a case in 1982 for an advisory opinion before the Inter-American Court on Human Rights, which was established by the Inter-American the American Convention on Human Rights, about whether the Guatemalan government had the right to create special tribunals, which they created under the Rios Montt regime, which were military tribunals to try people and then to publicly assassinate them. The Guatemalan government publicly assassinated four people 2 days before Pope John Paul arrived. Through that opinion, they brought the opinion. They wanted the opinion had a technical matter because Guatemala had signed the American Convention but refused to sign parts of Article 1 because it had to do with capital punishment again. And they said in their own constitution, they've had a discussion of capital punishment. There's certain things where they like to leave it in. And there is this whole question about the interpretation of the American Convention that jurists like to get their teeth into. So that's what it was about. The day that the advisory opinion was going to be judged by the Inter-American Court on Human Rights, the Guatemalan government decided to get rid of the tribunal itself, the secret tribunals. In fact, there was a coup the month before, a military coup the month before, where Mejia Victorez became, and the month after the coup was the Inter-American Court discussion of this, and so they won without even, the advisory opinion was then made, but it was really didn't mean anything because the state had already changed. So it's very important. So the commission has been, this public opinion is very, very important in changing the behavior of states. Let me then turn very quickly to Indian rights within the Inter-American Commission. There were approximately 6,000 complaints brought to the Inter-American Convention between about 1970, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, between 1970 and the early 1980s. Only 6 of 6,000 had to do with Indian rights. 6 of 6,000. It's relatively small, the human rights complaints that have been brought on behalf of the human rights of indigenous people before the Inter-American Commission. Although the cases that have been brought before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that have to do with human rights violations against indigenous people are amongst some of the most critical in South and Central America. There has never been a case that has had to do with North American Indians brought before the Inter-American Commission, although there's absolutely no reason why a North American Indian case couldn't be brought. There's cases that have had to do with Haitian refugees in the United States. The whole Supreme Court discussion of abortion and the right to life has been brought before the Inter-American Commission. The Inter-American Commission is currently considering a case of Salvadoran refugees in the United States. The invasion of Grenada and the bombing of the mental hospital on Grenada is now before the Inter-American Commission, in which the violation is looked at as the United States Department of Defense or whoever, the United States government in bombing a mental hospital. Did it violate the rights of, the people there? So, there's no reason why the United States government couldn't be a party to a complaint before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. But there's never been a case with U.S. Indians. Well, what have been the cases? The first case was in Colombia in 1970, the Guajibo Indians in Colombia. A group in Colombia in the late 1960s and early 1970s, there were enormous public attention focused on the fact that a number of Indians on the border between Venezuela and Bolivia, Venezuela and Colombia, were being hunted down by ranchers. They were actually being hunted down by ranchers. Indian hunting is a custom in parts of South America. It's part of the customary behavior of people in the backlands of South America. In a court, a first order court, a court of first instance, a group of Colombian ranchers testified that because Indians were animals, they weren't really conducting crimes against by killing Indians because they had thought of Indians as animals or savages. And on the first instance court, they were set free with that argument. It caused a scandal in Colombia on the national level and internationally. It was on the front pages of many newspapers. Some people remember this.
This is 1970.
It was 1968, 1969. It had to do with the Cuiva Indians. There was a Canadian, Bernard R. Cahan, who was an anthropologist at Montreal, I believe, who lived with the Cuiva and had documentary evidence that that had gone on. In fact, he was on a hunting expedition with the Cuiva where they were hunting animals for subsistence and where ranchers were actually shooting across the river at the Cuiva while they were to try to take over their land. At the same time, there were rebellions that took place where Indians fought back against this using bow and arrows against rifles and where the Colombian military was sent in to suppress the Indian revolts. And there were accusations that the Colombian military was actually bombing Indian areas and torturing Indians that it had captured that were resisting this. And the case was brought before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights by a group of priests in Colombia who joined with 100 theologians in Europe and the United States. Were the first wave of liberation theology, really. And on, quote, Thanksgiving Day, November 24th, is that when it is? They submitted in Washington at a press conference a denunciation. It was called the Committee of 100, and they were related to these Colombian priests, and they submitted a denunciation against the Colombian government, which was 3 years, was before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights sent back and forth notes to the Colombian government. The Colombian government argued that it actually was investigating this through its own judicial system, that it had put the Attorney General of Colombia to carry out an investigation, and that also that within the army itself, a military tribunal was carrying out an investigation, and that actually there were domestic remedies for resolving these violations. And after 3 years of discussion, the Inter-American Commission decided that there were domestic remedies in Colombia and decided to archive the case. And that was the first case, which shows you one of the ways they think. If there are domestic remedies, they feel that they don't want to continue to consider that, and that's really fundamental to a lot of their thinking. The second case had to do with the Aché Indians of Paraguay, where the International League on Human Rights, Richard Ahrens was the lawyer for them. The Aché Indians of Paraguay were also being hunted down by the Paraguayan government. They lived in the forests of eastern Paraguay that were being opened up enormously rapidly and deforested in eastern Paraguay. Mark Munzel, who was a German ethnologist, lived on an Indian reserve that was created called the Guayaquil National Indian Colony. It was created in the 1960s by the Paraguayan government, which was a dumping ground, really, for Aché that were pulled out of the forest and then dumped on this small Indian reserve where there was hardly enough land to carry out any type of hunting, which they were a hunting economy, in which they were provided with almost no medical assistance and were dying from disease, and in which the colonel who headed the Indian reserve was also one of the largest landowners near the reserve and would hunt down Aché in the jungle, bring them into the reserve, and then put them on the local ranches where they would serve as ranch hands. And also, there were evidence that children of the Aché were being given to families as servants. There's a custom again there where children are raised in families, Indian children, and then eventually become servants in the families. The case was on grounds of genocide. It was the American Declaration of Human Rights, of Rights and Duties of Man, Article 1, the right to life, and the International Convention on Genocide, which Paraguay was a signer of, the International Convention on Genocide. They submitted all the documentation to the Paraguayan government. The Paraguayan government was outraged. It responded, "We're the only country in Latin America that speaks an Indian language that's a national language, Guarani. We were the first country in the Americas to grant citizenship to all the Guarani in 1840. And Further, we have no policy of genocide. We have a policy of assimilation and integration, which is totally in accord with the International Convention 107 of the International Labor Organization. And they even went further. They said, we heard about the abuses on the frontier. We have gotten rid of the colonel that is running the frontier, the national reservation that they had, and we've put a North American missionary group called the New Tribes Mission to run the reservation, which has vast experience of Indian protection in all the countries of South America, and is supported by an immense amount of funds from the United States, which the Paraguayan government really couldn't put into this reserve. And so the situation is, it's a denunciation that really has to do with an international conspiracy against the Paraguayan government and has no truth to it. The Inter-American Commission did two things. It asked for an on-site visit, not only to look at the Aché situation, but also to look at about 200 or 300 other cases that had to do with a whole range of things. And it also posed a series of other questions to the Paraguayan government. The Paraguayan government, after its first statement on this, refused to answer any of the questions and refused to give the right to an on-site visit. There's a regulation in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the convention, if a government doesn't answer in 180 days to the thing, the Inter-American Commission would then hold a meeting and could decide that by not answering, the accusations must be true. And that's what they did. They said that these accusations must be true, because there was no answer to this. And they put a resolution in the annual report of the General Assembly to that regard. But they really didn't do much investigation of it. It was just a procedure. That was the second case. By about 1975 or 76, that case was ended. Then the third case, which had to do with lowland Indians, was the Yanomami of Brazil. Yanomami Indians of Brazil. That case was brought on behalf, the Yanomami are the largest relatively isolated group of Indian people in the lowlands of South America. Highways were built through the Yanomami region in the mid-1970s. Uranium was discovered in 1975. Large deposits of gold and tin with placer mining taking place. The Indians had no protection of their land rights. Disease was spreading enormously rapidly. Hundreds of Yanomami were dying from measles, from smallpox, from other introduced diseases. A commission was formed in Brazil that was putting pressure on the Brazilian government to create a large Indian park or reserve for the Yanomami. The Brazilian government promised to create the reserve, but always made promises and never did anything about it. And finally, in 1980, the commission in Brazil asked Survival International, the Anthropology Resource Center, the Indian Law Resource Center, and the American Anthropology Association to submit a complaint to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And we submitted the complaint to the Inter-American Commission, calling for an on-site visit to the Yanomami. That was the big thing, to get the commissioners to actually go there. The commissioners knew that in the early 1970s, Brazil refused to have an on-site visit. To accept an on-site visit is to accept that something is wrong, almost, to look at it. Other governments want to use on-site visits. There was also a Brazilian on the commission that was had been the oldest member of the commission, and there were some problems about that. Even though he didn't represent his government, he did represent his own nationality there, and that was a problem on it as well. But they didn't hold an on-site visit, but they did invite the people who complained to present oral testimony, which was the first time in the history of the commission that oral testimony was presented to the commission on behalf of an Indian complaint. The major discussion at the oral testimony had to do with three issues. Domestic remedies, you know, could the Indians go to court, you know, about this, We tried to point out that the only way they could go to court is by the Indian Bureau bringing the case in their behalf, because they're not considered to have any rights. They're considered to be like children. In Brazil, they're permanently incapacitated, I think is the way, absolutely incapacitated in the Guatemalan, in the Brazilian civil code. And how could they bring a complaint, the Indian Bureau, against itself in the Brazilian court system? The other thing it had to do was, did the commission have any jurisdiction over land and land? Because land is such, property issues are such domestic concerns that, although there's been things like the law of the sea and all these issues, is that traditionally questions of property and land are the concern of domestic law rather than international law, I take it. I don't know. But there's some concern about whether, and there was questions about mining on Indian lands, about whether the commission could really say anything about mining. And the third thing had to do with evidence. If they couldn't see it with their own eyes, how would they know that there would be what the difficulties of getting evidence in isolated rural areas? That was something that was plaguing the commission during the 1970s. When you went to Santiago, Chile, and you could go into the prisons, or it was in the stadium, the football stadium, where all the people were being held, they could go in there and interview people. But what happens when there were human rights violations way out in the isolated areas that were very difficult to assess the evidence? And they were concerned about, the evidence was coming mainly from anthropologists and some missionaries. The Yanomami couldn't come to testify to the commission. They may someday, but in this case, they're living in a different space. So there wasn't, the testimony was all presented not by the victims themselves, but by other people who weren't the victims. The one thing, though, that happened is, as they were considering the case, the Brazilian government, for the first time in March 1982, did pass a decree expressing its intention to demarcate an area for the Yanomami Indian Park, and which many of us think was a result of the fact that it was before the Inter-American Commission. And it was before the UN as well, and there was international discussion. It was sort of like that Guatemalan case. You know, there was enough publicity at that time, although there wasn't a great discussion of Indian rights in the commission, that the Brazilian government passed a decree expressing its intention. Since 1982, it hasn't actually implemented the decree, but it has expressed an intention, and there's the hope now with the new government and hopefully the civilian government that was introduced this week in Brazil, inaugurated, that that will be the first order of agenda in Indian rights. And almost everyone in Brazil feels that this is a certainty, that the new civilian government will take a stand on Indian rights. And I would take a close look at that. Betancourt in Colombia, Alfonsín in Argentina, and now Tancredo Neves in Brazil. Betancourt and Alfonsín, immediately after becoming presidents, came out with strong indigenous rights positions. And, you know, not that their words are, you know, a dime a dozen, but they came out, at least they had the words there, you know, and that was more than the military governments would have done previously. And one feels that the same thing will happen in Brazil. So those are the three cases of the six. Two other cases, and I'll mention these very quickly, have to do with on-site visits and have to do with massive human rights violations in Central America, which the Inter-American Commission has taken up. They have to do with Guatemala and Nicaragua, which the cases were beginning when the Inter-American Commission was concerned with Guatemala since the late 1960s, but always concerned with denunciations that had to do with disappearances, political and civil rights abuse. And it wasn't until their on-site visit of 1982, they tried to get an on-site visit all during the 1970s to Guatemala. And in 1982, were finally invited by Efrain Rios Montt to see the Beans and Bullets program and what they were doing. This was the cleanest pacification effort in Central America, and they were going to show to the world by inviting the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights how things were. and the seven members of the commission went to Guatemala and actually were taken into the Guatemalan highlands. They went to the Guatemalan highlands, and they also sent two members of their staff to Mexico to interview Guatemalan Indian refugees. And they came out with a report on Guatemala in October 1982, which showed enormous abuse of the indigenous population, which backed up the contention of massacres of indigenous population. It recognized that there was serious abuse by the guerrilla movements against the indigenous population and didn't retreat from the issue that the indigenous population of the Indian highlands of Guatemala was also being abused by the guerrilla movements. But the guerrilla movement abuse was nowhere on the level of what they call massive extrajudicial killing or massacres of Indian villages that had taken place. They also commented on the lack of right to religious freedom in Guatemala because of the suppression of the Catholic Church and the murdering of numerous Indian catechists, the lack of rights to movement and residency created by thousands of refugees and displaced persons. And their report was very important. The State Department at that time was claiming that Amnesty International had deceived international public opinion. Ronald Reagan had gone to Honduras to meet Efrain Rios Montt in December 1982, and his exact words were that Guatemala had gotten a bum rap. And the Inter-American Commission said the people of Guatemala had gotten a bum rap. And they backed up Amnesty International, and they were looked at their criticism. The Inter-American Commission is going back to Guatemala in May. In its last meeting, it's been invited again by the new government in Guatemala. After a report that has been done by the UN Relator, a British member of the House of Lords, who's done a report which is very congratulatory of the Guatemalan government in terms of what it's doing to its indigenous population. It has questions, the UN report, but argues that in the midst of an internal conflict between insurgents and the state, that the Guatemalan government, through its creation of model villages, is trying to resolve the problem. The Inter-American Commission will be going into the highlands to assess the model village program, the civilian patrols, and all these things that there's been a lot of publicity, and it's anyone's guess what they'll come up with, but they have been invited, and there's an enormous